Hello, everybody, and welcome to a Georgia History Podcast. This is Episode 1, An Outline of Georgia History to 1865. In the beginning, the water covered everything. It was said, "Who will make the land appear?" Sockchu, the crawfish, declared, "I will make the land appear." So he went down to the bottom of the water, and he began to stir up the mud with his tail and his hands. He then brought up the mud to a certain place and piled it up. The owners of the land at the bottom of the water asked, "Who is disturbing our land?" They watched and discovered the crawfish. As they approached him, he suddenly stirred the mud with his tail, and they could see him no more. Sockchu continued his work. He carried the mud and piled it up until, at last, he held up his hands in the air and the land appeared above the water. The land was very soft, though. It was asked, "Who will spread out the land and make it dry and hard?" Some suggested Ayok, the hawk, who should spread it out the land and make it dry. Others stated Yati, the buzzard, has larger wings. He can spread out the land and make it dry and hard. Yati undertook to spread out and dry the earth. He flew above the earth and spread out his long wings over it. He sailed over the earth and spread it out. After a long while, he grew tired of holding out his wings. He began to flap them, which caused the hills and the valleys to form, because the land was still soft. "Who will make the light?" it was asked, because it was very dark. Yo-Ah, the star, said, "I will make the light," and it was so agreed. The star shone forth, but the light It was only light near him. "Who will make more light?" it was asked. Sharpah, the moon, said, "I will make more light." Sharpah made more light, but it was still too dark. T'cho, the sun, then said, "Since you are my children, and I am your mother, I will make the light. I will shine for you." She went to the east, and suddenly light spread all over the earth. As she passed over the earth, a drop of blood fell from her to the ground. And from this blood and earth spread the first people, the children of the sun, the Yuchis. Now, what you've just heard is the beginning of an oral creation myth from the Yuchis, one of the Native American tribes that inhabited Georgia before the Europeans arrived and began recording written history. This was one of a number of the creation myths that existed from one of the many groups of Native Americans who were present in Georgia at the time. And let's back up for a minute. At the end of Episode 0, I said that we'd pick up with a discussion of General James Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia. When I said this, I had every intention of doing just that. However, as I was preparing for the episode, I realized that it was probably best to set up the podcast a bit more before jumping into the various stories. I think that a good way to do this is by outlining a long arc of Georgia history. Today's episode will start at the beginning and run up until 1865. I think this outline will serve two main purposes. First, it will serve as a general overview for those who aren't familiar with the quote-unquote high points of Georgia history. And secondly, it will serve as a general starting point for our joint understanding of the context from which the podcast's different stories will be told. In laying down a basic outline, we will have a common jumping-off points from which to dive deeper into the various people, places, and events that we'll be discussing. And this outline is by no means nearly comprehensive enough, but it is meant to be a basic, bare-bones set piece more than anything else. With that stated, let's get started. The Yuchi creation myth notwithstanding, about 450 million years ago, two tectonic plates collided, which started the formation of the Appalachian Mountains. Some 200-odd million years later, the last great supercontinent, Pangaea, began to break apart, and the seven continents that we know and love today began their long process of taking shape. On the southeastern corner of the future North American continent, the Appalachians, which were old mountains at this point, were beginning to erode. By about 100 million years ago, they were nearly flat. This was about the time that T-Rex and another type of dinosaur called Ornithomimosaurus, and I just slaughtered that, I know, which was essentially an ostrich dinosaur, this was the time that they were roaming the area. So just as the dinosaurs were about to make their curtain call about 65 million years ago, plate tectonics of the Cenozoic era began to re-uplift the Appalachian Mountains. This process rejuvenated stream flows, which in turn created the valleys and deposited materials from the eroding mountains across the rest of the state. During this period, much of southern Georgia was still covered by ocean waters. It would remain covered for quite a long time until about 2.5 million years ago. The general area where the ancient seabed ended is today called the Atlantic Seaboard Fall Line. The fall line marks the border between the Piedmont and the coastal plain regions of Georgia, and it can be found running from Alabama to New Jersey, all along the Atlantic seaboard. A notable feature of the fall line is that the rivers were not historically navigable above this area. Native American settlements at these points eventually transitioned into some of the cities that will play heavily into our state history, such as Augusta, Milledgeville, Macon, and Columbus. By the time the seas had departed from South Georgia, mammals had become the dominant animal type all across the earth. In Georgia, mammoths, mastodons, giant ground sloths were present. As a quick aside, if I could go back to any period from our history for a safari trip, this would probably be the point that I'd choose. There were also, apparently, a large species of chipmunk that roamed the mean streets near Cartersville. I'd like to propose a fun task now. If we take these four species as a starting point, I think we should create our own list of a big five animals for Georgia's prehistoric safari tour that none of us will ever get to go on. I will be glad to give a shout out to the listener who proposes the coolest fifth animal to add to this list. I hope some of you are now saying challenge accepted. Now, let's get back to the story. As best we can tell, the settlement of the Americas began sometime between 20,000 and 10,000 years ago. Current research is constantly changing our understanding of not only when, but how and by whom the settling occurred. But for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to stick with the traditional telling. At some point in the past 20,000 years, a migration occurred which brought Eurasian settlers across a temporary land bridge created in the Bering Strait between modern Alaska and Russia. It was temporary by geologic terms at least, but it's possible that it lasted for up to 20,000 years. In due time, these first peoples worked their way across the entirety of the American continents, with some of them eventually ending up in the area of Georgia. Again, there's a lot of back and forth about when and how humans settled the area, but it's generally agreed that by 10,000 years ago, numerous cultures had popped up all across North and South America. Our story is going to pick up in earnest about 1,200 years ago with the rise of the Mississippian culture. The Mississippians were a mound-building civilization that began to populate the Mississippi River Valley and parts east somewhere around the year 800 AD. Their civilization was dominant in Georgia from about the year 1000 until just prior to the arrival of Europeans. The Mississippians built large mounds, some of the most impressive of which in Georgia are the Etowah Mounds near Cartersville and the Okmulgee Mounds in Macon. They had developed large-scale use of corn-based agriculture, which could support quite large population centers. Estimates say that the Mississippian city located at the Cahokia Mound site in Illinois may have contained between 6,000 people on the low end and possibly as many as 40,000 people at its zenith in the 1200s. If that higher number is correct, it would put Cahokia on par with the city of London's population at the time. Comparatively, a city of that size would not exist again in North America until Philadelphia hosted James Madison and Ben Franklin as they were working on the Constitution. Regardless of the size of the Mississippian cities, they had developed a complex society filled with vast trade networks that stretched from the Rocky Mountains across the eastern half of the continent. Their society was stratified, and it had all the trappings of social inequality and the concentration of power into the hands of small groups of religious and political leaders. Does anyone else think that this place is starting to sound pretty familiar? As with all great civilizations, the struggles of development would catch up with the Mississippians. Just prior to the arrival of Europeans in the New World, the Mississippian culture began to disperse and disseminate into many successor native tribes. Some modern historians conjecture that the beginnings of the Little Ice Age, which is generally considered to have occurred between 1500 and 1800, may have been a contributor to this decline. Whatever the causes, one of their successor peoples, the Muscogee, plays a large role in the early days of the Georgia colony. The Muscogee, whose river-based settlements caused the Europeans to dub them the Creeks, are a group of Native Americans encountered by the first Spanish explorers to traverse the Southeast in the early 1500s. A successor to the Mississippians in many ways, the Muscogee had become one of the predominant tribes in the area through the conquering of many smaller neighboring tribes, at least according to their early oral histories. I must pause now and admit that my own expertise in pre-European history is quite limited. This is one of the areas which I hope to address later in the podcast after I have had a chance to read more. So in hopes of not saying something stupid or just plain wrong, I'm going to refrain for now from jumbling too many of the details and move along with the introduction of the Europeans. Again, this is not intended to gloss over the pre-arrival history of the Muscogee and other eastern tribes such as the Cherokee, but it's more to ensure that when I do attempt to tell their stories, I'm able to do so in a manner that's fully informed and accurate. I promise that if this podcast lasts more than a few episodes, I will come back to these folks and will give them appropriate attention to their history. Now, historians think that the first European who is most likely to touch Georgia soil was Lucas Vasquez de Allon. Allon was a Spanish judge on the island of Hispaniola, which is modern-day Haiti and the Dominican Republic, who decided to attempt settlement on the mainland continent. He had been encouraged by a feeler he had sent to explore 5 years previous, who ended up capturing some native slaves somewhere in South Carolina. Allon's expedition landed in South Carolina in late September 1526. Within a couple of weeks, they had worked their way along the coast to establish the colony of San Miguel de Guadalupe on October the 8th. Modern scholars think that this settlement was most likely located on or near Sapelo Island, which is one of the barrier islands that runs the length of Georgia coast. Regardless of where exactly the colony was founded, it was a complete and abject failure. Allon died within the month, and most of his settlers died before the end of the winter. A mutiny of the local population and some of the slaves brought by the Spanish were stopped, but not before it convinced the remaining Spaniards that settling the area was just not worth it. They commenced packing up their things and sailing back to Hispaniola, though not before one of their two remaining ships sank, leaving one small vessel to ferry the 200 or so survivors back home. An interesting side note to this story is that some of the slaves that the Spaniards had brought escaped while they were along the coast. They fell in with some of the Gualey natives, making their mutiny both the first slave revolt in the New World and becoming some of the first non-native permanent settlers on mainland North America. European exploration really ticked up 13 years later when Hernando de Soto landed in Tampa Bay with 9 ships and more than 600 men. After wintering in the panhandle of Florida, de Soto crossed over into Georgia and began to head northeast. Now, it's not known exactly what route the group took, but a popular route takes him right through the heart of the state. This proposed route has been somewhat substantiated recently, with artifacts being found within the past decade in Telfair County along the Ocmulgee River. I posted a map of this route, which was initially suggested by Charles Hudson in 1997, on the podcast website www.georgiahistorypodcast.com, which shows De Soto continuing up into the Carolinas, looping down through Tennessee, and turning back through northern Georgia before heading westward. De Soto himself would die during the expedition while camping along the banks of the Mississippi River. The rest of his explorers, harassed by natives and a difficult winter, eventually made their way down to Mexico City. It would be a difficult journey for the survivors, and when they finally arrived in the city, only about 300 of the 700 men who had begun the expedition were left to tell their story. Now, the trip itself, aside from ending up pretty much a failure, it did have a lasting impact on Georgia and the southeastern United States. The Spanish introduced pigs to the area, whose descendants would later develop into some of the feral hogs which to this day plague farmers across the southeast. The explorers also introduced disease to the native populations. Measles, smallpox, and a host of European diseases hitherto unknown to Native Americans would go on to devastate the populations over the next half century. It was the death knell of whatever portions of the Mississippian cultures remained in the area. Estimates of North America's native population prior to Columbus landing in 1492 generally rank in the 20 million levels, with some more radical projections suggesting that even closer to 100 million people were living on the continents prior to European arrival. Now, there's no way to really know what this number was for sure, but suffice it to say that the continent was not by any means abandoned when the Europeans arrived. By the year 1607, however, when Jamestown, Virginia was founded, the native population had declined by as much as 90%. De Soto wasn't the only explorer who introduced diseases, but the swath that he cut through the southeast made him one of the first, and more or less the last, European who would ever witness the villages and cities of a functioning Mississippian culture. By the 1560s, and the French had set up a small settlement on Paris Island in present-day South Carolina. Around that same time, Spanish colonists in Florida re-explored inland Georgia, noting that most of the people De Soto had encountered in his travels were no longer present. Eventually, the Spaniards forced the French to abandon their settlement, and neither the Carolinas nor Georgia, which the French referred to as Gaul, a la the ancient name that the Romans had for France itself, were given much attention for the next few decades. Native Americans began to reestablish their population slowly until the English created the province of Carolina in 1629. As the British began to settle the colony southward, they formally established the colony of South Carolina in 1670. Eventually, outposts began sprouting up in various parts of what would soon become known as Georgia. These trading posts helped to establish trust and trading relationships between some of the Native American groups and the British, which would be essential to the survival of the soon-to-come Georgia colony. One downside to these posts, however, was that it increased friction between the English and the Spanish. Spanish Florida felt that they had retained some claim to the area by establishing two missionary provinces north of St. Augustine, which focused on converting the local Gualey and Mocama populations to Roman Catholicism. Mocama province extended from St. Augustine up to St. Simon's Island, which is another one of those barrier islands on the Georgia coast, and the Gualey province ran from there up to the Savannah River, which served then and today as the border with South Carolina. In the late 17th century, the British began backing friendly native groups to attack these missions, eventually invading themselves in 1702 and finally pushing the Spanish missions out of the territory. The Yamasee War of 1715 began when a number of natives who were settled in South Carolina attempted to oust the English from the colony. While unsuccessful, the Yamasee and their partner tribes did inflict much bloodshed on the English, which led to a change in how that colony was governed. If someone does a podcast on the history of the Carolinas, there would be a wealth of stories from this event alone which would be very much worth discussing. The long shot of the war for our purposes, however, was that the native population became too dispersed and weakened to repel the English when General Oglethorpe and a group of trustees were eventually granted a royal charter to create the Georgia colony in 1732. Now, Oglethorpe, Savannah, and the founding of the Georgia colony will be the subject of our first deep dive, so I won't go into incredible detail here, but settlers did begin arriving at Yamacraw Bluff, the site of the city of Savannah, on February 12, 1733. The colony was governed by trustees back in England until 1752. Over that period of time, Oglethorpe and his settlers established a number of forts and communities, attempting to create a buffer colony between Carolina and Spanish Florida. A rarity among the British colonies was that it was intended to function without African slavery. Yes, Georgia was founded to be slave-free. Now, slavery is abhorrent in any time period, but it was also extremely common in the 18th century. But for reasons which we'll discuss later, this very peculiar circumstance at the time did make pragmatic sense. As I said, Georgia was intended to serve as a buffer between the Spanish and Carolina, and Oglethorpe dreamed of the colony as a refuge for poor debtors from England, so it was not intended to be a plantation-based economy like the previously established colonies to the north. However, once General Oglethorpe successfully thwarted Spanish expansionism on St. Simon's Island at the Battle of Bloody Marsh in 1742, the threat which precipitated the need for a buffer state was essentially removed. From then on, pressure began to mount on the trustees to allow slavery in the colony, and while they resisted for a while, in 1751, Parliament decreed it to be so. With the introduction of slave labor, the economy of the colony quickly moved to become more familiar to that of the Carolinas. As a result, the population exploded to nearly 33,000 by the time of the American Revolution. Still, growing wealth and social stratification amongst the white settlers did lead to some friction within the colony. When the Second Continental Congress was convened in 1775, Georgia elected multiple representatives, but most did not attend due to disagreement upon how they might move forward with independence once they arrived. Initially, only one representative, Lyman Hall, attended the Congress. Eventually, the colony did send two additional delegates, George Walton and Button Gwinnett, to be seated in Philadelphia before the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. With independence, Georgia had essentially declared statehood, but it was to be short-lived. Skirmishing by Patriot militias and a few failed invasions of now British-controlled eastern Florida preceded the British turning their attention southwards after they lost at Saratoga in 1777. By late 1778, the British had captured Savannah and later proceeded to march towards Augusta, which is further up the Savannah River. British and Patriot forces would swap victories at the battles of Kettle Creek and Briar Creek, but the Brits would regain and hold on to control of the state, I guess we're a colony now again, for about 3 years. Eventual victory by the Americans in the Revolutionary War would allow the reestablishment of the state of Georgia in 1782, for good this time. At this point, the state technically retained its original colonial borders that stretched all the way from the Savannah River to the Mississippi River. However, in the 1790s, some of Georgia's elected officials, including Governor George Matthews, began selling off large swaths of land in the unsettled portions of Georgia that were west of the Chattahoochee River. There were two main, really big problems with this. First, the land had not yet been procured from the Native Americans, not even by the often farcical standards of such deals at the time. Also, the governor did not have the rights to sell the land, much less personally pocket the cash from those sales. This episode is known today as the Yazoo land fraud. As a result, the federal government forced the state to cede much of the land that was west of the Chattahoochee River, land that currently makes up most of the states of Mississippi and Alabama. How our own state got its shape is actually a very interesting set of stories that I do intend to discuss further. For now, it should suffice to say that between this event and some really poor choices in awarding surveyor contracts, Georgia had settled into its current borders by 1817. Significant portions of the state, particularly in the northwestern corner, were still occupied by Native Americans, namely the Cherokee tribe. It was in 1829 that the discovery of gold near Dahlonega caused a large influx of white settlers to migrate into the areas that were still owned by the Cherokee. This tension spilled over with the passage of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, which required the removal of Eastern Native Americans to the Indian territories west of the Mississippi River. The Supreme Court case Worcester versus Georgia resulted from this friction, establishing that the Cherokee Nation had certain rights which prohibited their removal. Chief Justice John Marshall wrote the court opinion stating these rights, and it is from this case that we get the possibly apocryphal quote from then-President Andrew Jackson stating, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." The Indian removal that followed under President Jackson and later President Martin Van Buren is one of the saddest stories in Georgia history. The evils of African slavery notwithstanding, it just might be our state's own original sin, and I do intend to cover it in detail at an appropriate time. Another thread that stemmed from the 1790s was the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney in Savannah. The machine made economical the mass harvesting of cotton, and cost decreases resulting from it dramatically increased demand for cotton production. So-called keen cotton made the population of Georgia boom, which doubled by 1840 to almost 300,000. A significant portion of the population increase was due to the additional black slaves that were being brought into the state to work on the cotton plantations. Continued economic dependency on the plantation system reached a climax with the arrival of the 1860s. The election of Abraham Lincoln and the threat of slave emancipation scared Georgia planters. They could see their very livelihood slipping away from them with the potential freeing of their slaves. The irony of their position apparently lost upon them. On January 29, 1861, the Georgia General Assembly issued the Ordinance of Secession. The state was admitted into the Confederacy a few days later, and over the course of the war that resulted, nearly 100,000 Georgia soldiers fought for the Confederacy, though, in fairness, about 5,000 Georgia soldiers did serve the Union in some capacity. Additionally, some communities, primarily those removed from the larger plantations of southern Georgia, remained largely loyal to the Union throughout the war. Fighting did not come to Georgia in earnest until the Battle of Chickamauga in September 1863, when the Confederate forces repelled Union forces just across the border from Chattanooga, Tennessee. What commenced was the second deadliest battle of the war, behind only Gettysburg. Eventually, though, Union forces reopened supply lines, which paved the way for General William Tecumseh Sherman's 1864 Atlanta campaign. The city of Atlanta had formed at the terminus of the Western and Atlantic Railroad and was formally incorporated in 1847. It had about 10,000 residents at the outset of the war and was one of the major industrial hubs of the Confederacy. General Sherman began his invasion of Georgia in May 1864. Fighting tough resistance the entire way, he reached Atlanta by July 22nd. He then besieged the city until it fell on September 1st, and after demanding the civilians leave, Sherman used the city as a base of operations for a couple of months while preparing to march to the sea. On November 11, 1864, on his way out of town to capture Savannah, Sherman ordered the city burnt to the ground. Very few buildings were spared, and to this day it is largely considered a formative event in the history of the state. After he left Atlanta, he kept marching and burning and freeing slaves along the way until he reached Savannah on December 21st. After an agreement to be spared the fate of Atlanta, the city of Savannah surrendered without fighting. Sherman sent a telegraph to President Lincoln saying that he was, quote, presenting as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah, unquote, a gift which Lincoln accepted with pleasure. Sherman then rested his troops for a month and continued his march up through the Carolinas, finally ending in Virginia as the war itself was ending. Now, Sherman's march is a central component of the state's self-perception of its past, and come hell or high water, you can bet that I will be covering the march and its impact on our state in a future series of episodes. For now, that gets us to 1865, which is where I'm going to end for today. Getting into Reconstruction and the post-war events really pushes us into a new territory that I don't think the podcast will get into for quite some time. When we do begin to approach stories which require a better understanding of that time period and events beyond, I will probably do a similar outline episode to bring us from 1865 to the present. So, as we depart, I want to encourage listeners to reach out to me through the website, www.georgiahistorypodcast.org, via email, GeorgiaHistoryPodcast@gmail.com or on iTunes, where you can find this podcast and subscribe. If you like what you're hearing so far, please leave a review or tell your friends about this project. I appreciate your listening, and I hope to see you back next time as we talk about General James Edward Oglethorpe for reals this time.